Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with former Louisiana Poet Laureate Brenda Marie Osby, whose new collection is All Souls, Essential Poems, along with James B. Borders IV, whose new book is Marking Time, Making Space, an essential chronology of Blacks in New Orleans since 1718. It's a special pleasure to welcome my next two guests to The Reading Life. Brenda Marie Osby is a Brown University professor, former State Poet Laureate of Louisiana, and American Book Award winner. Her new book is All Souls, Essential Poems. And longtime journalist and consultant, former editor of the Black Collegian magazine and New Orleans Tribune, James B. Borders IV is the author of Marking Time, Making Place, an essential chronology of Blacks in New Orleans since 1718. Brenda Marie, welcome.
Hello.
James, so nice to have you here.
Thank you, Susan. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we're getting to the essentials in history and the essential poems, which I love. So Brenda Marie, let's start with you. Reading this book, for me, was such an amazing journey through those things that have always been important in your work, the lives of women, the lives we live here in New Orleans. How did it make you think anew about what is essential in your work, putting this together?
That's a really good question, because that was the entire project for me. I didn't want to do a collected poems volume that included everything that I'd written since I sprang from the loins of my mother up until my, you know, most recent last gasp. I wanted to pull together those works that, despite when they had been written or how long ago they had been published, those works that shared certain common themes or that shared a certain narrative bent. And so the main thing was, for me, was to identify what those primary themes would be or could be, and to group the poems in that manner, and then to take away the stuff that wasn't essential to that theme or that narrative bent.
And how long did you work on this?
A long time.
You're looking at James here, which I love.
Well, I'm looking at him because he lived through every possible version of this book that ever existed. And there are certain things that, in looking back, I think maybe I ought to have included. But there are many more things that other people have asked for and said, well, why isn't this poem in there? And I said, well, because it wasn't essential. Don't you get it? But it took a few years. And I started out with one publisher who was also a poet who then died. And then I was without a publisher and needed to shop it around a bit. It took a few years. It was I can't quite recall now, because now that it's in a nice, beautifully bound volume, it's like it's always been there. And in a sense, I guess it has always been there, because all of these poems, most of these poems, have been there for some time.
Did it make you feel differently about your own work? I mean, did it make you kind of sit up and go, wow, I did that?
It felt important. It did. I probably shouldn't say that, but I'm shameless, so
no,
I'll go ahead and say
it. I read it.
But it felt important. It felt as if I'd reached a certain moment in my work as a writer to have a collected poems volume and to have a sizable volume. I'm one of those people who counts pages.
Now we know.
How many pages in this book? How many pages in that book? So it felt important to me to have a hefty volume, and one that I had really shaped. Because, as you know, there are a couple of ways of doing collected poems volumes.
Right.
The easiest way, I think, may be to have an editor make the selections, do all of that stuff. And in fact, a couple of poet friends of mine have said, oh, you should never have bothered with that. You should have just given it to somebody and let them do it and so forth. But I really wanted the book to be my vision of what was essential to a reading of my work as a body of material. And so it took a long time and I labored over it.
And I love the way it's arranged. I love the flow of the book, you know, and you feel your sensibility guiding the reader through it. So one of the things I love most about your work is the way you write about women in New Orleans, groups of women, individual women, the challenges they face, the traditions they keep, the magic they believe in at times, and often the sadness of their lives. And I wonder if you'd read one of your poems about women, the old women on Burgundy Street.
The old women on Burgundy Street. The old women on Burgundy Street braid the years into their gray, brown, white hair. They put patient time into the pinning of a plait, braiding in equal ones and twos. For various reasons, some will braid by morning or late evening, after supper songs, after dishes and cats have been put away. Only once or twice have I seen one braiding at noon. The old women on Burgundy Street drink bourbon from coffee cups while the sun goes down. It cures rheumatism, gout, and ailments left over from the change of life. They braid in French braids, a neat basket weave that does not interfere with a profile or a bowed-down head. Some of them I have seen braiding songs into their hair, sipping from those coffee cups, sitting out on front porches or just inside an open sidelight. They do not moan. Their songs have an air of learned resignation.
Oh, I love that. It seems so timelessly New Orleans to me, you know? And yet, some of your work is directly historical and commemorates special moments. And so I thought I'd ask you to read Requiem for a Chief, the poem you wrote for Tutti Montana.
Requiem for a Chief. In memory of Big Chief Allison Tutti Montana, 1922 to 2005. Kandenlanda, Banga la Kwenda, Banga la Kwiza. From the Congo proverb, family is a channel. People go out on it, people come in. All of them people dead, but in my heart I kept it going. Chief Tutti Montana himself. 2.5 billion, science tells us, is the number of heartbeats in the course of an ordinary human life, and most of us anyway have only a little while to stay. Till one day death comes dressed in white, and dressed to kill, carrying only his lantern and his own shroud, and just like that we go, if we're lucky, or mighty, or blessed. Sometimes, in spite of ourselves, we do what is right and good for one another, or make some effort, but like as not we slip and falter and shirk. And every year more young bloods fall down along the littered and illiterate city streets. Sometimes a warrior comes, and then he goes, and when he goes out, we sing his song. If we are lucky, and if we are blessed, we will live to tell it, how there is a city where the chief was a true chief, and as soon as death called him, the chant went out, the tale went round, and 14 days the people told it, and 14 days the people sang, until they were ready enough for the slow drum and tambourine, the final crown of gold and the lifting up. And when the storm held back, and the songs all turned to prayer, it was just too beautiful for words. It is not true. It is not true. His heart did not weaken or fail or give out. He gave it to us, so that somehow 2.5 billion seems a small, small number for such a chief, such a mighty, mighty man who gave to all our city his warrior's heart of gold.
I think we should all have that poem in our pockets all the time. You know what I mean? That's such a New Orleans poem. Now, in addition to editing your own work, and surveying so much of, you know, what you've done over the years, you've devoted a lot of time to the work of others as well. And I wonder if you'd talk about your latest project.
This most recent volume is Gabriel O'Carra Collected Poems, edited and with an introduction by Brenda Marie Osby. which was indeed a labor of love and devotion. Gabriel Okara is the African continent's oldest living poet. He is also the first modernist Anglophone poet of Africa. He turned 95 on the 24th of this month. He's still walking to the university a couple of days a week to teach his classes. He's quite active. He doesn't travel very far from Nigeria these days, however. Although I met him in 2011 at Brown University. We were reading on a program, and I had known and admired his work since I was a young girl, taking courses at Dillard University. And his son, who lives in the Boston area, said that his father needed a publisher for his collected poems. And so I said, I'll find a publisher for your father. At the time, I didn't have a publisher for my own collected poems. But I wasn't just talking big. I really meant that I would put my project aside to locate a publisher for Gabriel Okara. And I approached two publishers, both of whom wanted the book. African Poetry Book Series is an imprint of University Press of Nebraska, and the imprint is that of the poet Kwame Dawes. Kwame Dawes is a world-famous poet who is Ghanaian-Jamaican-American. And we had a chance to talk at a literary conference, and it was the first time I'd heard of African Poetry Book Series. And so immediately after the panel discussion and reading, I snatched him and I mentioned to him that I had the manuscript, and he said, "Do you have it with you? Because I want it." So we began working from there. Little did I know that that would turn into my becoming the editor of the volume. I thought I could just deposit the manuscript with them and they would do all of the work. The manuscript needed work because it had been manually typewritten by a few people. Some things were photocopied and sort of pieced in and so forth. So there were minor technical things like that that had to be got around. There was British usage as opposed to American standard usage. Those things had to be changed. The main thing for me was going through the work. It's a surprisingly small volume unless you know that Gabriel Okara was on the side of Biafra in the Biafran War. And so when he and his family were moving around Nigeria, they were frequently in flight. And he had to leave behind many papers, manuscripts, books, all kinds of things. Then at the end of the war, when Biafra was defeated, people who had been on the side of Biafra had to go through a kind of processing when they were assigned new places to live in the fully reconstituted Nigeria. Gabriel Okara presented himself and had a small sheaf of papers in his hands. Those papers were taken from him. They were confiscated by Nigerian government representatives. And so he lost even more work as a result of that. The entire body of his work includes poems, short stories, fables, children's stories, the experimental novel for which he is rightly famed called The Voice, dramatic poems, and I think at least one play, as well as articles, because he was trained as a journalist. So once his son Ebi and I got this project mostly out of the way, we began talking about doing a volume called The Gabriel Okara Reader, in which we would gather together as much of what remains of his work. And what's really nice about it is that once I started having that discussion with Ebi, he began talking to other family members. Manuscripts long thought lost began to appear. So a granddaughter located a collection, a group of short stories of his in manuscript form. And so we now have more work of his. So now we're working on the Gabriel Okara Reader, which
we hope
will be a two-volume thing.
Well, we should cherish those manuscripts that have survived always. That's an amazing achievement. Now, James, let's turn to you for a bit. You've been involved in New Orleans history for so long as it's unfolding. Mm-hmm. So what made you undertake this chronology of 300 years of Black historical landmarks?
Well, there were a couple of things. One is, of course, that we were coming up on the tricentennial of the founding of the city. And I started to notice how agency and voice of Black New Orleans was being framed in a way that didn't capture the full spirit. History has these ebbs and flows, but we're now in a period where the Black contribution to New Orleans is being shunted off to a side that looks like it's just new minstrelsy. And so what I wanted to do was to make sure that we told the fullest story about the work that we had done in New Orleans and the foundational contribution that we've made to the city and its economy, not just as Black bodies sold in the country's largest slave market, but some of the other achievements against the odds that we were able to make.
Mm-hmm. So how did you choose these events? What was your criteria for this? Because this is a lot of history to choose from. You have packed a lot into this book, too.
Yeah, thanks. I think I wanted it first to be kind of data-driven. I used the census as the spine of the book, just to look at how our numbers grew, shrank, changed, and morphed, right, as enslaved people, as free people. And then from that started to look at the corollary achievements that were taking place during those decades. That's basically how it started. And I had, obviously, lots of moments that I thought were important, legally, politically, culturally. And then as I started to fill those in, I came across other stories that I thought were important to share as well with folk.
Mm-hmm. But the numbers, the census numbers are so shocking. Mm-hmm. You know, as you read through it, it just comes back to you again and again and again. Mm-hmm. And then at the very beginning, when you chart the arrivals of the slave ships, just the bald facts of that give you chills, really, I find.
Yeah, and the fact that that first ship was the L'Aurore, the dawn, right? That really was, you know, the dawn of a new age, a new era right here. And it's a little ironic, but at the same time, it is what it is. And I wanted to make sure that we didn't sugarcoat the facts either, right? We just wanted to present them so that folk would have them. And the next generation and this generation as well would have this benchmark from which to start to build and to understand our place here.
Mm-hmm. Well, the interesting thing is that basically the book is a long list, but that's what people love to read these days. Yeah. And it's so compelling just
Thank
to
you.
Go through yeah. this. But it's really an astonishing compilation of events. And I'm curious, what did you come across that you didn't know? Was there anything that surprised you about what you found? I mean, you've grown up with this history, you've researched it, you've been a part of it. So what was the pleasure for you in doing this hard work? What did you learn?
Yeah, there were lots of things that I learned. And for me, this really goes back several, I guess, decades or so, when I started looking at New Orleans history, basically first through W.E.B. Du Bois's Black Reconstruction. But also around that time in 1970, my mother became the senior archivist at the Amistad Research Center. So then I slowly started getting all these stories and information about papers and collections and histories that were not yet included in history books going forward. And then later I started to read people like John Blasingame's Black New Orleans, 1860 to 1880, and other histories that came along. And then started to hear the arguments that people were making about sometimes the misrepresentations, the misunderstandings that outside historians had about New Orleans and what happened here and how they interpreted a lot of the information that they came across. So that was one of, the elements that was kind of propelling me to say, well, maybe it's time that we do this ourselves and set the record straight in a way. And so I thought I had a pretty good handle on what had happened and what had occurred. But there were a number of things that surprised me. One was the 1865 incident in September with the Raquette humbug. Raquette was, the precursor to what we call now lacrosse, what lacrosse had become. But in New Orleans, it had become the first organized sport. And then there were the traditional teams, the Bayou and Ville, who would play each other, the country team versus the city team. And there'd be 40 folk per side, and they would play on Sundays and have big picnics and affairs. And the Native Americans played it, the Choctaws played it. They then in turn taught it to the Africans and the free people of color. And then the white Creoles started to play the game. So the game got Creolized, all the terminology and everything. And then 5 or 6 months after the war was over, there was this incident at one of the matches where a white player was killed. There was some kind of humbug. And the mayor of the city later heard that there was talk about retaliation for this killing, this fight that had taken place. And in order to avoid further bloodshed, he banned raquettes as a sport, the matches. And so that first great organized sport that New Orleans had died and it was never revived. Fortunately or unfortunately, 10 years later or so, baseball had kind of taken over the city and it moved forward and never looked back. But that little unknown story about how raquette could have been such a major factor here really gave me pause, because I always think of lacrosse as being an East Coast game.
Of course,
we think of Syracuse and Johns Hopkins as being, you know, the college powerhouses and the like. And you'd never think about it having such heavy roots and anchor here in New Orleans and in the Deep South in that way. So that was an opportunity lost, I think, yeah, in our city's history.
Well, it's so interesting to read this book because so much of this, James, is sad history. There's so much grief in this book, and yet so much achievement, you know, and that's a lovely kind of balance you strike for the reader, at least.
Thanks.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
And it makes me think of, what is it like for you too to share life and work? Because you share many of the preoccupations. I mean, some of the figures that are so important in your poems, Brenda Marie, are fleshed out in James's book, like San Malo and Luis Congo. I mean, so what are your conversations like? Are you really kind to each other when you're in the throes of writing? I want to know.
James is extremely patient, and patience is not a quality that I have, so I admire it in others. I tend to bug him a lot, I think. I don't necessarily always call him, but I'll shoot him emails about something I'm working on, or sometimes I need his ear. He's got a really great ear. Years ago, a mentor of mine said to me, it always helps to have someone who has a really great ear and a sharp critical eye. And I found that to be true. And I think James is probably my best critical reader and has been for many years.
And what about you, James?
Well, Brenda Marie has always been so deeply immersed in the history. Even though she's a poet, you know, she's really rooted in the history and the archival documents. And because she's so much more fluent in French and Spanish than I am, I can trust her interpretations and translations of the documents much more than I can with my own kind of muddling through trying to piece things together. And yet we generally settle in on similar perspectives about figures, about their significance, about their deeds and the significance of those deeds and some of the backstories that don't get told. Now, she has a really great talent for being able to extract those historical facts and flesh out great stories about it. The piece about the head of Luis Congo Speaks is one of those great ones as well, because then it's infused with all this cultural understanding of the Congo. And there is a lot of that that's still hidden and underneath Congo flavor, Congo culture. Their sense of inversion is so heavily rooted in New Orleans culture that we, in many respects, forget that that's where it came from, that that's where that edge that we get comes from. And she's great about going back and placing it in context and fictionalizing it in a way, but nevertheless keeping it deeply rooted in the historical fact. That's always a pleasure for me.
Well, and it must be a pleasure to you too to know she's writing poems to you and for you. I love that.
Yeah, that's a blessing. Yeah,
that's a gift. Yeah. That's a real gift. Yeah, and I love the way you acknowledge your debts to one another. And you know, when you talk about your book beginning in a list of things she had started and your poems to him, it's a really lovely thing. We've been talking with Brenda Marie Osby, whose new book is All Souls, Essential Poems, and James B. Borders IV, author of Marking Time, Making Place, an essential chronology of Blacks in New Orleans since 1718. You can meet them Wednesday, May 18th at 6 when they're in conversation at Octavia Books. Thank you so much, Brenda Marie.
It's been a pleasure being here.
And you too, James.
Thanks, Susan. Enjoyed it. Yeah.
Thank you. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Pamela Tyler discusses and signs New Orleans Women in the Poydras Home, More Durable Than Marble, Tuesday, May 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Brenda Marie Osby, author of All Souls, Essential Poems, and James B. Borders IV, author of Marking Time, Making Place, An Essential Chronology of Blacks in New Orleans in 1718. Appear in conversation Wednesday, May 18th at 6 at Octavia Books. Brandon Black, a steampunk author who lives in New Orleans, presents his most recent anthology, Cairo by Gaslight, Wednesday, May 18th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Blood Jet Poetry Series hosts Fiction Night, featuring readings by Desiree Evans and Allison Alsop, Wednesday, May 18th at 8 at BJ's in the Bywater. The Garden District Bookshop presents Roy Blunt Jr. signing Safe Room for Pie, Food Songs and Chewy Ruminations, Thursday, May 19th from 4 to 6 at Catfish and Henry, 2138 Magazine Street. Catherine Soniat reads from and signs her new collection, Bright Stranger Poems, Thursday, May 19th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Peyton Burgess reads from and signs The Fry Pans Aren't Sufficing, Friday, May 20th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Laura Lane McNeil, author of Doll Baby, discusses her work at the meeting of SOLA, the South Louisiana chapter of the Romance Writers of America, Saturday, May 21st at 10 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses The Solitude of Prime Numbers by Paolo Giordano, Saturday, May 21st at 10:30 at Octavia Books. In the tradition of Andrea Garrity's New Orleans Poetry Forum, Robert Minuet hosts a new poetry reading series every Sunday from 1 to 2:30 at the Neutral Ground Coffee House. Please bring 10 copies of the poem you wish to read. There will be an open mic reading Sunday, May 22nd at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Ryan Fertel and Denny Culbert, author and photographer of The One True Barbecue, Fire, Smoke, and the Pitmasters Who Cooked the Whole Hog, discuss and sign their books Sunday, May 22nd from 3 to 5 at MoFo, 514 City Park Avenue. Enjoy a whole hog roast by Chef Michael Gulotta. Michael Murphy, author of Hear Dat, a guide to the rich musical heritage and lively current scene, appears in conversation with drummer Stanton Moore, singer Michia Lake, and offbeat Stan Ramsey, Monday, May 23rd from 6 to 7:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Press Kabakoff and James Farwell discuss and sign Revitalizing Cities, the HRI Vision, Tuesday, May 24th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Here are some upcoming events associated with First Folio, The Book That Brought Us Shakespeare, on exhibit at Tulane University's Newcomb Art Museum through May 31st. Oliver Hennessy of the Xavier University English Department discusses Shakespeare on the stages and streets of New Orleans, Wednesday, May 18th at 6 at the Williams Research Center at the Historic New Orleans Collection. That's in conjunction with the HNOC's exhibit, Mary as the Day is Long, Shakespeare's Hand in New Orleans. Lisa Wolpe presents Shakespeare and the Alchemy of Gender, May 20th through 22nd at the Lupin Theater at Tulane. Check out neworleansshakespeare.org/tickets for information. And Antenna is seeking submissions of short fiction, nonfiction, poetry, or prose for inclusion in Antenna Signals 002, a print publication to accompany Antenna's quarterly thematic live arts magazine event. Submissions should explore the theme of reflections on exile, displacement, migration, dissociation. Each written piece must be 1,500 words or fewer. Up to 10 will be accepted. Each piece accepted will receive an honorarium. The deadline is May 21st. And coming up, get ready for Walker Percy Weekend, June 3rd through 5th, which celebrates the 50th anniversary of the moviegoer in the historic district of St. Francisville. There will be panel discussions and social events. Special guests include Jason Barry, Mary McKay, Christopher Harris, and Patrick Samway. For more information and tickets, check out walkerpercyweekend.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.